hppodcraft.com.
Blah, 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 ladies and gentlemen. And you know what that means. It's the special bonus Marches for Dracula's episode on a film concerning Dracula's. This isn't something we always do, but we should, because it turns out there's a lot of movies on this topic.
We figured we would watch a movie that we always meant to watch but never got around to doing, Only Lovers Left Alive, written and directed by Jim Jarmusch.
I kept waiting for it to be on a streamer, even though it cost me, I think, $4 to rent it. Jarmusch's recent zombie movie, The Dead Don't Die, is on HBO streaming. Okay. I haven't watched that yet, because every time I see it, I think I don't really want to go down that road without having watched the vampire movie, because the zombie movie got bad reviews. This movie got great reviews.
It's got 85% on Rotten Tomatoes. People love it. It stars Tilda Swinton, Tom Hiddleston, Mia Wasikowska. And then Anton Yelchin. It came out in 2013.
I got a lot of pressure at the time to see it, and that weird thing happens where you go, well, then I'm not going to see it because you recommended it. And the next year, the same thing happened with What We Do in the Shadows. I was stubborn about both. It took me forever. But what companion pieces?
Well, yeah, you know, there's a crossover, right, with What We Do in the Shadows in this movie.
There is?
Yeah. The Council of Vampires, Tilda Swinton.
Oh, that's right. You're
right. Is this character.
And I knew that that's where she was from, but I didn't.
Yeah.
That was another time I went, I got to go back and watch that. Both of them had a long gestation period.
Yeah.
What We Do in the Shadows, they made a movie called An Interview with Some Vampires in like 2005. That's a short version of that movie. So they've been wanting to do that for a while, but the aesthetic of both was so similar.
Yeah.
Right away, when the font came up for this movie, it looks like What We Do in the Shadows. Yeah. The palette was similar to that movie. So that was kind of interesting. And as a result, I almost couldn't take this seriously for a moment. Not that it really wants you to. It does have a wry humor about it. When we were watching the first part of it, I said to Heather, here's my review. This is my favorite movie of 1993. Do you know what I mean?
Yep. Yes.
Like, I feel like at that age, at that time, I would have watched it 30,000 times.
Yeah.
Easily. Mm-hmm. And it did have that feel like a 90s indie film, probably because of the director.
Sure. It's Jim Jarmusch, and I'm a fan of his. I haven't watched a lot of his recent stuff. My first Jim Jarmusch movie was Dead Man, and I saw that at the Lemley in Santa Monica on 2nd Street in 1995. Man. But another great Jim Jarmusch film was Ghost Dog, which came out in 1999. Mm-hmm. Blew me away. I love that. Forest Whitaker's in it. He's like a mob hitman, but he studies the way of the samurai.
Yeah, I love the soundtrack in that
movie.
It's
so good. He's well known for Down by Law, which came out in 1986, Night on Earth, 1991. I saw that. That's the one with taxicabs in different cities.
Oh, yeah. I just watched part of that recently, actually.
He's pretty much made a movie every year since 1986. Now, he was born in Ohio in 1953, so he's just 4 years younger than my dad, which is kind of weird. In my mind, he was always just maybe a few years old, maybe 10 years older than me, but no way, man. He's much older than I am. He watched a lot of B-movies when he was a kid, and he got into cinema that way. He was really into Burroughs and Kerouac and that kind of stuff. But then he got a fake ID to go to porno movie theaters, and he saw like...
Smokers.
Yeah.
Let's go see some smokers.
He was like into that porno movie theater scene, and he would see other underground movies, like things I've never heard of. I've heard of Warhol's Chelsea Girls, but then Robert Downey Sr. made this movie called Putney Swoop. Never heard of it before, but I guess it's one of these underground kind of arty, sexy, you know, kind of movie things. So he was into that whole scene. He went to journalism school at Northwestern in Chicago, but he never actually took any journalism classes, so that he went to Columbia with this intention of becoming a poet.
Northwestern's hard to get into as well. He's a smart guy. Why does it weird you out that he's around your dad's age? That's an interesting...
I don't know.
Is it because he's just like uber cool and it's weird to you that they're the same?
That's exactly what it was.
You know, if Jim Jarmusch and your dad were hanging out, they would have the same frame of reference on stuff.
Oh, but. Yeah, absolutely. But for me, in my mind, he was much younger because he seemed so cool that he wasn't that old.
Because I have the old dad. Mm-hmm. I have a weird thing that happens to me where, so for example, I've been watching a lot of old movies lately from the 40s. And you and I were talking about Veronica Lake. And then I look up her age and I'm like, she's like a year younger than my dad. Mm. Like, these people were his contemporaries. It's so weird to me.
Yeah.
Because I knew, you know, he was 50 when I was born. And so he was just that guy. And like, to think about that is so, so strange.
It's really weird.
It's also weird. So Jim Jarmusch goes to Columbia University with the intention of becoming a poet. That's always such a curious thing in the modern world.
Yes.
It's kind of interesting because Amanda Gorman here from Los Angeles is now a huge deal as a poet. She read poetry at the Super Bowl.
Oh, right.
Because she read at the inauguration for Joe Biden.
Right.
And to see that happen is so interesting. I was thinking about it recently because I watched this movie Smithereens from 1982 and Richard Hell's in it, who I know from the punk seen, but I was reading a little bit about him, and it was the same thing. He went out to New York to be a poet when this was a thing that people were like going out to do. And then he got famous for being a punk rock guy and then went back to that. You know, he's known now as a poet and as a writer. Speaking of Smithereens, since we're going off on a little film tangent here, and it is really brief, but that's a Susan Seidelman film, and she's most probably best known. She made Desperately Seeking Susan and then
The
pilot for Sex and the City. So she, but her first movie was this movie Smithereens, which is very indie, and it follows this really awful young woman who wants to make it in the punk scene is just sort of vampirizing all of these different people to do it. But she's compelling. You can't stop watching her. Now, there's a section in the movie where she goes to the movies and there's a sci-fi thing playing in the background. And there's a little scene in the theater. That sci-fi movie, there's a narrator. And I go, that sounds familiar. You know who it was? Edward French, who has read for our show a couple of times.
Oh, wow.
is in the movie Smithereens as the narrator of the weird fiction movie that's playing in the theater.
That's awesome.
I when his name came up in the credits, I was so proud retroactively.
That is a rabbit hole. And that's what you get here on your bonus content.
That is what you get.
We're getting crazy rabbit hole in here, but that's it. Let me pull it back a little bit.
Yeah.
After New York, Jarmusch went to Paris. He lived there for a year, and that's when he got into international cinema. That's where he finally saw like French movies and Japanese movies, and like, you know, he got to see all this other stuff, and it kind of blew his mind. And then he went back, finished up in Columbia, and then applied to film school, got in, and that's where he met with a bunch of other guys that eventually make it. He collaborates with them later, like Spike Lee, for example, is a dude he went to school with.
Now, Spike Lee, I don't know if you saw this in the news for the last couple of days, but they've announced that he's doing some mythos thing with Netflix.
Yes.
He's doing something called Gordon and Hemingway in the Realm of Cthulhu.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. No, I don't know. It's crazy. Now, Jarmusch's first film was his graduate project called Permanent Vacation. And then he did Strangers in Paradise, which folks loved. That was in 1984. Then Down by Law, which had Tom Waits, Roberto Benigni, you know, the guy that won the Academy Award for Life is Beautiful.
You know, I'm always happy to watch one of his movies. I'm also happy that I haven't seen them all. I'm not really an obsessive, I'm more of an obsessive sprinter. I get really into something. I go down the rabbit hole about halfway. Then I come back out and I move on to another one. I'm not the kind of person who will exhaust a director's whole repertoire or all of a show.
Yeah.
I like that because then later there's more for me.
Yeah, I can see that.
Speaking of, I haven't seen a lot of John Cassavetes' films, but I always admired him because he's the kind of guy who would make something for money and then go with his own dough and grab his actor friends and make something. And he's got this movie, The Killing of a Chinese Bookie. And a lot of it takes place in a strip club where there's a host who thinks that people are sometimes coming to see his material. And you just reminded me of it because porno theaters used to be very much like that. When you had to go see pornography in a theater, they might slip in something that's really low budge and crazy. Uh-huh. And you would have that odd person who actually came to see that. Uh-huh. I'm not going to get that at the multiplex, but I might see this weird film at the Pussycat or whatever. And that's interesting that he got some inspiration out of that.
So this movie, Only Lovers Left Alive, like you said earlier, he tried to get it made in 2010, but had a hard time finding the money. It's super low budge. It's $7 million, which I know sounds like a lot of money, but for a movie that's shot all over the world and with name actors in it, that's
insane.
That's really small budget. It didn't make much box office. It was 7.6. So usually movies that don't double what their cost is, they consider those flops. But, you know, if I made a movie and then got that money back.
If they broke even in box office, then that movie's going to make a lot of money because it'll have a long life. It depends on what the deal is with the distributors. You know, I've been here too long because I think about all those things while I'm watching, especially with this one because it was in Detroit. And so I was going, oh, that's a 30% tax break right there. You know? Especially if they show, a little of the town and they name check a couple tourist attractions, they actually get another added bump for that. And then 2 seconds later, he's like, hey, you want to stop by and see the rock? Or what was it? You want see the Motown Museum.
Yeah. I mean, it works for this story, I think.
It absolutely works. In fact, I really liked the setting.
Originally, too, you know, it's Tom Hiddleston's part was supposed to be Michael Fassbender, but there was some scheduling conflict.
You know about him, right? Like, what's the Sound of Music guy?
Christopher Plummer.
Michael Fassbender's his clone. That's a project that they initiated. Have a look.
Okay, I'll check it out.
He cloned himself.
I'll check it out.
Watch Sound of Music and tell me that's not Michael Fassbender.
Okay, you got it. But I mean, it was shot all over the world. It was in Detroit, it was Tangier, Hamburg, and Cologne. Those were all the shooting places. And it's very impressive. The look of it, it doesn't look like a low-budge movie at all, I think.
No, God, not at all. It's beautiful to look at. And like I say, the Detroit setting, they had a really effective sequence where they went into an old, gigantic, beautiful theater that was now a car park. The urban decay of it, just the sense of time and the how things are temporary, you know, which this was all about. It really, I say that about the tax breaks, but it was a beautiful place to set it. I mean, it really was built into the story.
It was. And Jim Jarmusch, he did the soundtrack where his band did, which I think is pronounced Squirrel. It's spelled really funny, but I think it's S-Q-U with a umlaut over it. L.
Dick.
Something like that. I don't know.
Yeah, it's purposely inaccessible, which is perfect for this because... There was the really funny, wry kind of Tom Hiddleston saying, oh, I hope she doesn't get famous at the end. That'll ruin it.
Yeah.
L.A. is zombie central. I loved this idea they presented that we are a zombie infection. It was just sort of what they call humans, zombies. But it does also, if you think about it, you go, wow, if these are really, really old vampires, and it's implied maybe they're Adam and Eve, but I don't know if that's true.
Yeah.
But the idea that we're a plague that they just have to deal with. This is all post-apocalyptic. The vampires had it straightened out and then humans showed up.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
But the music, I liked it a lot. It had a little bit of a My Bloody Valentine vibe to it, I thought, because it was very droney, which I go, is rock and roll even going to be something that somebody's going to be into who's this old?
Mm-hmm.
But it was, you know, what worked about it so well is it was very non-specifically arty and it didn't sound like any kind of genre. Because I think about that with something like the Vampire Lestat, who's a rock star in 1984 at the beginning of that book, what would that sound like? You know, winger? It would immediately become silly once you're out of that year. And there's evidence of that if you see the Queen of the Damned movie, because they do some music videos in the beginning of that. Whereas this was great because I think it would have fit in any era. And it definitely was about, because he was obsessed with those guitars, it was about the sound. What do each of these fetishistic items give to you in terms of how the pickups grab the sound from the strings? And I could see somebody hundreds of years old getting really obsessive about that.
Yeah. What's good about this movie, or what I think it does well, is that idea of how quickly things change, because they've obviously been around a long time. So to them, they see things come and go, and they see fashion trends and politics and all these things don't matter so much as we think they do, because we're in it and we only exist for the short time. And they don't really get into it deeply, but it's kind of hinted at that that's how they feel about humans and what's going on. And I think that's good.
It was a cool human dynamic that was set up with them because they weren't too specific about it.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure. I mean, there was an obvious light dark thing going on in that. I thought, is this going to be an angel devil thing? Is he more indulgent and she's more balanced? But actually what it was very much like the discussion I have here with Heather, or did when things were in really bad political crisis, where, and this theme came up where he said, I feel like all of the sand's dropped to the bottom of the hourglass. And she said, then it's time to pick it up and turn it over. And you see that happen thematically at the end of the movie when John Hurt passes away.
Mm-hmm.
She's devastated. And then she says, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go get you that instrument that you wanted. She turns the hourglass over.
Yeah.
I'm going to move on to something active that we can do, because life's here for us to enjoy. And so the dichotomy between them wasn't good, evil, or light, dark as much as it was moody and positive.
Yeah.
You know, it was a very human thing where he said, I can't, it's what these zombies are doing. They're ruining the planet. I'm hung up in it. And she doesn't deny it. She says, that's true, but there's music to listen to and there's dancing.
Well, yeah.
That vampires could have that discussion, or you and I could.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what makes it good. And there's another plot element to it where humans are polluting the planet so much that they can't drink from humans anymore because it makes them sick. So they have to get special O negative blood from a hospital that's not, doesn't have pollutants in it, toxins and all of these things. So the world is falling apart for them in a way that probably never has happened before, that they're in short supply of what they need to survive.
I thought that was great to play in the B story in the subtext. You know, you had those Jeffrey Wright scenes where you learned about that.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't the main plot, but it definitely took them out of the monster world and put them more in it. These are immortal people dealing with human problems.
Yeah.
And they've evolved in that. I think later in the movie, when they are forced with having to drink blood from somebody, she says, oh, it's that 15th century shit.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to, that's all, that's what people used to do.
Yeah.
Or that's what vampires used to do. It's, so not only can they not drink, it's two things. They can't drink from the polluted And who knows what it is in the blood that they don't want anymore. Yeah. But it's, you know, I imagine it's a slew of additives from food and the psychoactive drugs that everybody's taking one way or another, mm-hmm. hormones, all of these things would probably affect them pretty poorly. It almost brings back that idea of virginal blood into the vampire myth. Mm-hmm. There's scarce resources for them. I mean, it just really mimics the problem of the universe. The problem of humanity. And I thought that also the thing they did with this that was so great is Tom Hiddleston's character had interest still, especially in energy. And he continued down the path of things that people had dropped, Tesla's ideas and whatnot. So his car had a really cool perpetual power source of some kind in there.
Yeah.
And he was working on that, those things. And that when they were in moments of great despair, they thought about what's happening in the cosmos, because even though they're vampires, they're limited by this planet too. So the wonder that they find is what's happening 20 light years from here.
Some really good stuff in this movie. Also, some stuff that kind of bugged me a bit. I don't know if we should even go.
Yeah, tell me about that. What was the issue you had?
I got the impression that Jim Jarmusch isn't into vampire movies, like, or books. Like, he hasn't read a lot about vampires, because he does this thing in here, which is, for me, a huge cliche. And it's stuff I'm pretty tired of. I felt like I was watching the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles. You know, it had that same problem where they have to have known every famous person ever. Yeah. You know, like, they drop names, or they were there during big events in world history. And the world's a huge place. Like, what are the odds, you know, you're going to be at this place that's going to be big? John Hurt, the character you were saying in there, he plays Christopher Marlowe, Shakespeare's mm-hmm. contemporary, and he was a playwright as well.
Wrote Faust. They imply in this movie that he wrote all of Shakespeare's plays.
Yeah, because he calls Shakespeare an illiterate idiot, I think, at one point in the movie. A few people have suggested that that's the case, but I think that's been pretty much thrown out. That,
well, yeah, that, but that, to your point, I thought, well, who cares?
Yeah.
And then I thought, why would these vampires even care? I mean, there were a couple of things wrong with what you're talking about. One, why do we have to learn that they've been this old through their interactions with famous people? It'd be much more interesting if, you know what I never get from history, because it's full of the exploits of famous people, what was life like for everybody else?
Yep.
They have an opportunity there to say what that was.
Yeah.
And so it's missed. And then also, just in a scene where people know each other and then discuss things from their shared history in such a expletive way, it just takes me out of the movie.
Yes.
You know?
And there was a lot of that. So I caught myself eye rolling at a bunch of things in this movie. To me, it feels like somebody that is kind of new to vampire fiction, these things might be exciting to them. Or like you said, this would have been your favorite movie in 1994.
Right. Then I would have been like, oh, cool, they're doing that thing that, you know, Vampire the Masquerade did, where Yurgis Rudkus and Al Capone are vampires.
Right, yeah.
It was okay at that point, I guess. I don't know. Yeah. It didn't bug me as much.
No.
I agree with you, man. And if they really are Adam and Eve, you had a problem, like, racially, too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they're white. If they were the first people, they would not be white.
I assumed that those were monikers. Like,
yeah.
There's no way they're actually.
Another thing that I really liked about it was the chemistry that Hiddleston and Tilda Swinton had. But dude, check this out. Did you know that she is 20 years older than him?
Oh, yeah. Dude, I was just telling you, there's a movie called Orlando from something like 20 years ago where she looks exactly the same, and she, I think that one's like a werewolf movie, but she turns into Billy Zane. That's as far as I can tell from reading the description of Orlando. It's about either Billy Zane turns into Tilda Swinton or she turns into Billy Zane.
Yeah.
And terrorizes like the countryside in the 1700s or something. It's something
like that. Yeah. One, their chemistry is good, and at no point did I ever think she seems older than him. Like, it just never even occurred to me. But she's 20 years older than he is.
The only time that I actually thought that she looked older was when she looked at a photo of them from 100 years before and said, oh, we look so young. It was played as a joke because obviously they look exactly the same.
Yeah.
But that was the only time where in that photo I went, how old is Tilda Swinton?
Yeah, she's 60 years old.
Yeah, well, she was in that video with David Bowie because everybody always compared them. So they did like a video together.
Oh, wow.
Where they're playing the same person, or maybe it's another Billy Zane situation. I didn't see the video, but when I looked that up, I remember going, oh, they're around the same age. Yeah. I mean, maybe 10 years difference.
10 years, yeah.
And I actually just watched Freddy's Dead, Nightmare on Elm Street 5, as I referenced on that episode with Ken Height, and that had Lisa Zane in it.
There you go.
If you want to know what Billy Zane would look like as a woman, I suspect that actually was Billy Zane, also able to. using his Orlando powers to make a little extra money.
There's,
as Lisa.
Just a couple other things I want to talk about in this.
Yeah, yeah.
Is Anton Yelchin is in it. And of course it makes me sad because he died so tragically and he was such a young dude. But he plays kind of this helper for Tom Hiddleston's character. He sends him on odd jobs, but the guy's like a fan of his as well because Tom Hiddleston's dude has some kind of notoriety. His character Adam is a musician, so he's this recluse musician, and he goes and gets some stuff, and he's like this real nice kind of rocker guy, and he keeps trying to give him money, and he gives him money, but he keeps saying, no man, you give me so much money already. He goes, no, take it, and then he does take it. So it's a good character dynamic because they're like, is this guy really nice, or is he just saying no, keep it, even though he knows he's gonna give it to him anyway? So he just plays that part
well. Jarmusch is very experienced and a very confident director because he goes ahead and lets you have some tension and he doesn't pay it off.
Yeah,
he must know that we're feeling that way, because with Anton Yelchin, these other rock and roll kids were showing up.
Yes.
And I kept waiting for them to home invade. Mm-hmm. I kept waiting to find out that he was giving them details or telling, because at one point he asks to use the bathroom.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, is he scoping the house?
Yeah.
None of that was going on.
Nope.
And I'm sure that Jarmusch knew that I would think that. And so he just lets me think it. And that made it an engaging, hooky movie. But what a great actor, because it's a somewhat implausible character of a dopey rock and roll dude who's able to get like a solid wooden bullet and all of these 100-year-old guitars.
Yeah.
I mean, he's like the Shawshank Redemption, you know, I can get you anything guy, but he's also seems like such a witless 25-year-old rock dropout. And I totally believed it.
Yeah.
I totally believed it. Yeah, I just thought he's a really talented, nice guy, and he just really loves rock. But it was also really funny that people were just showing up outside. I thought they were going to rob him, but it was playing on that idea of the more reclusive he is and the less he lets people hear his music, the more desperate they are to hear it.
Yeah. One of the other main characters in there, they keep talking about having visions that Eve's sister is going to show up, which made me think, oh, is she like the baddie of the whole thing? Because they have dreams. They have like premonitions that she's going to show up. And I'm like, oh, what's that going to be about? But when she shows up, that's Mia Wasikowska. And she's...
Little Crimson Peak reunion.
Oh, right. Yeah. That was Tom. Well, this might be pre-Crimson Peak.
Oh, you're right. Maybe it's a union. And that was the reunion.
That was the reunion. But she's in from LA. She's this flighty, looks like she's a lot of fun. He doesn't like her at all. Adam is like, I don't want your sister around. I don't like her. And she's like, no, she's family, you know, we got to just kind of put up with this. And she comes in, she's kind of real sensual and sexy, but also super narcissist, and when she's done with you, she's going to be on her way. She had that kind of character to it, and I thought that was interesting because the expectation I had that she was going to be this baddie, and she was just kind of a shitty person.
She was, well, yeah, it was funny because one, it at least reinforced that they do have this blood addiction, because there were a couple of times where Hiddleston or Tilda Swinton would see blood and just zone out.
Yeah.
They were unable to stop looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
They did have to have some restraint. They were sort of like adult vampires. Mm-hmm. And when she shows up and is just like, come on, where are you keeping your supply? Give me more of it. I want it all. And she just immediately binges it and can't. So it just, that was a very vampire-y part of it.
Yeah.
And her name was Ava. I thought it would be Lilith, which also led me to believe these are just people who have taken these identities on because they're so old.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was funny because I really related. I'm like, yeah, man, I'm totally the Tom Hiddleston in this movie. You know, like, he's got all this cool equipment and he's like up there rocking. And then when she showed up and she was like, I'm in from LA and I'm going to drink all of your booze and then I'm going to wreck everything. And I'm going to leave. I'm like, oh, I'm actually this person. This is like me going to stay with my sister and Joel. Like, didn't we have a bottle of vodka down here?
And of course, she ends up killing Anton Yelchin's character. She like drinks him dry. And then she gets sick from it because his blood's polluted.
Yeah, that was funny. He's a rock and roll guy. What are you doing?
That was good. And then they just kick her out of the house and she's yelling at them, you're going to be sorry. You'll see. And then nothing really comes of it.
It is funny because there is so little like vampire power stuff that goes on in there. Yeah. There's a couple of like fast movements and you see fangs here and there. But that it's because it's so downplayed that I marveled that she left their house in the worst part of Detroit and just walked out on the street and left. And it's because she's a vampire. What does she have to worry about?
Yeah.
But it's so dangerous what she was doing.
But I mean, that's pretty much the movie. The end of it, they're kind of hard up for blood. They don't know what they're going to do. And they decide they're going to make some people like you were saying, they're going to make some people some vampires because John Hurt died.
They didn't have their blood supply, so they actually had to get some victims old style. But, you know, this is the thing. I want to make sure that we don't forget about the outer space thing. They were also talking about physics here and there, and Hiddleston's character was really interested in this Einstein, the spooky action of the particles when they've been pulled apart still influence each other, and that's a real thing.
Yeah.
That is unexplainable.
Quantum entanglement.
And I forgot about it sometimes. But when he was bringing it up, I go, you know, there really is still wonder in the universe. How the hell does that work?
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
When they see the other couple right when they're dying, that's a little bit of spooky entanglement. They show up the meal that they need right then. Or at least they're using that to justify the murder in their mind.
Well, they're not going to murder them. They said they're going to make them. They're going to turn them into vampires.
That's what they said, but I got the impression that was what they were telling in themselves. Like, you know, 2 minutes later, it'd be like, oh, oops. Well, we had the best intentions.
Yeah.
You know, it's like when you sign up for a workout class the day after Thanksgiving or something. The thing about that, though, is it does leave you saying, even these people that are exhausted by centuries of time, there is still wonder and unexplainable things. There's still a planet, you know, a crystal star out there that emits a sound. You know, these things were dropped in there to let us know. There's still wonder in the world.
Yeah.
And I think that that is a little of Jim Jarmusch saying, look, you know, especially the way that Hiddleston keeps pointing out the bad electrics that humans have set up all over the place. The evidence is all around us of the chaos. But look up, see that there's wonder, see that there's possibility that things may change and turn that hourglass over. I thought I had a really positive message at the end.
I like watching a movie every once in a while that's slow, that takes its time, that focuses on mood and atmosphere. And if you can get over the famous people name drop and stuff, then it's a really enjoyable film. I recommend
it. Yeah, it's the kind of thing that you used to be only able to see at a porno theater.
Well, that concludes our bonus content. Hopefully you guys liked it. I want to thank you patrons for being freaking awesome and supporting us at the level you do. We do the show for you guys.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to HP Podcraft bonus content.
HPPodcraft.com.
I don't know what you mean. I was being serious.
Quit that. Be a nice guy, will you?
Okay, come on now.
What?
Better not play games with me or I'll bite a hole in your neck and suck your blood out. Remember, I'm the big, bad, bloodthirsty vampire.
Don't! You're scaring me!
Ah, don't be uptight. Come on, give me a kiss. What's happening? I don't believe it.
Me